about comparative religion. If you have questions, please don't be shy. No. Thank you very much. Please help me welcome His Holiness Jai Rinpoche.
Sanskrit, the word is dharma, which is quite a freighted word. It has a lot of different meanings to it. But in the context in which I want to pick it up, it means the permanent engagement, the permanent function, the permanent function of a living being. There's To give an example, it can be said that, well, dharma comes from a root, which means to sustain. So the sustaining quality of something can be said to be its dharma. Just like water, it's wet. When it's not wet, it's not water. Water will always be wet. Chilly has to be hot. And so you can say that the dharma of chilly is to be hot. The dharma of water is to be wet. So living beings have an inherent quality also, an inherent dharma. And when the Vedic sages look at that, yeah, you've got a spot to sit. Saved you a spot. When the Vedic sages look at what it is that's the dharma of a living being, his permanent engagement, his permanent activity, they say that it's to serve. If you look at it, the storekeeper is serving the customers, the parents are serving the children, the citizens are serving the state, friends serve one another, husband and wife serve one another. All sorts of people are serving, and we really can't escape it. It's our nature to serve. If nothing else, I may say, well, I don't serve no one, but then I'll serve my senses. I'll serve, but now my service is directed in a temporary way. I'm serving my country, which may not be my country permanently. A Canadian becomes a Frenchman, a Frenchman becomes a German, what have you. I'm serving my family, but my family is not permanent. Another temporary gathering. I serve this, I serve that, I serve cause, but none of these are permanent. They come and go. But when service is connected with the Supreme, then it's called Sanatana Dharma. Dharma means that permanent engagement, and Sanatana is almost redundant because it means eternal or permanent. So when we speak of religion in the West, we usually mean a kind of faith, a kind of faith that you join. So a Christian decides to become a Buddhist decides to become a Jain, a Hindu decides to become a Christian, a Protestant decides, actually, I'd be better off as a Catholic, and so on. It goes on. And we switch in terms of particular doctrines, particular affiliations, but it's not permanent. If you were to go to the spiritual world, you wouldn't find little arrows pointing to the Protestant section, the Catholic section, the Hindu section. These are in a sense, superficial. Not that they don't have meaning, but they all point towards something deeper. The outward rituals, the outward affiliations, the historical setting has meaning, but it has meaning because it points to it, toward that permanent engagement of the living being. So there's a verse in one of the Vedic writings, Srimad Bhagavatam, where the question is posed, what is the best religion? Or what is the best dharma? And the answer is given, Savaipam Sampado Dharma Ito Bhaktir Dokshaje. That religion is best, or that system of spiritual advancement is best, by which we reawaken our tendency to be connected with the Supreme through service. That's the best. It doesn't say Hindu's best, Christian's best, this is best, that's best. That process by which we reawaken our dharma, our eternal nature, our connection and service, this word bhakti yoga, yoga means connection. And bhakti can be translated in different ways, but one meaning is that it's service. So, but it's permanent service. Now the service is directed toward the temporary, and in bhakti yoga it's directed toward the eternal. So that process by which we develop our tendency to serve the Supreme, by which we connect ourselves with the Supreme, that's, he says, the best dharma. Ahoituki. Ahoituki means without a motive. It's not that, well, I'll serve, and what will I get? No. Ahoituki, without any motive. And apratiyata, without any impediment. And I'll do it no matter what. Yayatma supersedeti. That's the process by which the Atma can mean mind, can mean self, Atma can mean soul. Take it as your inner self, Atma. The process by which the Atma becomes supersedeti. Precedeti means satisfied. And supersedeti means exceedingly satisfied. We'll not be satisfied. A secret of the material world is that it's the place where no one's satisfied. Up to date, so far, however long history has been going on, we're doing so many things to get happiness and satisfaction, and none of them work. None of them work means that I'm not actually going to be satisfied in the material world, because I'm not part of the material world. I'm a foreigner in the material world. And trying to settle here, first of all, is inconsistent with my nature. And second of all, it's impossible, because if I want to settle in the material world, I can't settle because I'm going to be kicked out. Death comes and says, here's your eviction notice, you can't stay. Even if I think it's great, I love it, it's wonderful, no place better than Cape Town, just give me Cape Town forever, I can't stay. I'll be kicked out. My job, my family, my home, my country, planet, death comes and says, now get out. This is the actual problem of human existence. The problem is not how to get more money, how to get better food, how to be better adjusted. The problem is what to do about the problem of death. That's the problem. And generally, philosophers and, well, so many people are busy skirting that problem. You see horses with blinders so that they don't get distracted. You don't want to get distracted by this thing called death, because it's very unpleasant and it gets in the way of our pretty picture. But the Vedic approach is to look at it head on, stare in the face and say, what are we going to do about this? None of us likes it. None of us wants it. What do we do? So from there, it becomes a larger discussion concerning the difference between the body, which is temporary, and consciousness, soul, atma, inner self, whatever you want to say, which is said to be permanent. We have a child's body, get a young person's body, get an old person's body. The body is always changing. But the self within the body is permanent. And the Vedic literature will say that permanence means really permanent. When this whole body is finished, it's already finished. I can't give me $1 million in exchange for my showing you my childhood body. It's gone. There's nothing I can do. I can't collect. So that body's gone. The young body is gone. The old body will be gone. Then death comes, another change of body, and so it goes. So that provides the context for Sanatan Dharma, or the business of getting beyond this cycle of birth and death and reconnecting ourselves with our spiritual existence, our eternal existence, or our eternal engagement. That's a quick introduction. In that context, then, comparative religion, well, how does Protestantism stack up against Catholicism? How does Catholicism stack up against Greek Orthodoxy? How do they both stack up against Islam and so on? Becomes a minor concern. We become less concerned about this religion or that religion, just as we're less concerned about whether someone is American or Canadian or German or French or Indian. The real question is how we revive our eternal nature, how we get back in contact with the Supreme or with the Absolute, how we divert or redirect our service from matter to spirit, from the temporary to the eternal, from the world where everything is going to be finished to the world where everything is constitutionally of the same nature that we are. You're eternal, I'm eternal. There's another world beyond this one, the Vedic literature says, which is of that same eternal nature. By turning away from that spiritual nature, we turn automatically toward the material nature. And the process of yoga is to correct that mistake, that fundamental mistake, by different spiritual methods, through meditation, through chanting. There are so many different ways. But that method is best by which we actually connect ourselves with the Supreme. Okay, I'm going to be short and see what kind of questions you might have, rather than talk on and on.
What is your definition of the Supreme?
What is my definition of the Supreme? Good. The Supreme is described in Vedanta Sutra, in the very beginning, as the origin of everything, that from which everything emanates. Then, in Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a commentary on Vedanta Sutra, it's described, the Supreme is described as having three aspects, or being perceived from three angles of vision. What is that? Well, first it says it's the same Supreme that we're talking about. We're not talking about three Supremes, but the same Supreme seen in three ways. The first way is the Supreme is an all-pervading reality. The underlying reality, the truth that's beyond, or that forms the basis of everything, and the the source of everything, an all-pervading transcendence is the Supreme. Having no manifest form, no manifest qualities, but being present everywhere. That's called Brahma, and that's the beginning realization of the Supreme. Just as like the beginning realization of the sun is to see the sunshine everywhere. Then the next realization is to go further and say, well, the Supreme is in my heart. Not only is the Absolute everywhere, but very specifically, there is a higher source of direction that I find when I turn within myself. It's not me, but there's a reality beyond myself from which I get knowledge, from which I get forgetfulness sometimes, by which I get remembrance, by which I, you know, every one of us has the experience that a voice is saying, don't do it, and then we do it, or do it, and then we don't. So that presence of the Supreme within the heart is called Paramatma, or the super soul, and that's the second realization. Just as you might turn around and say, well, the Supreme is not only everywhere, the sun is not only everywhere, the sun's on my head. And not only my head, but her head and his head and everyone's head. In America and China, the sun is very directly there on everyone's head. So in the same localized way, God is present within your heart. Paramatma. And then the third feature is called Pungalan, which is a personal realization of the Supreme. Just as you're a person and I'm a person, so the Supreme can also ultimately be realized as the Supreme Person. When we think of the all-pervading Absolute, that all-pervading Absolute is missing qualities and form and intelligent direction. But when we come to the personality of Godhead, then you find everything is there. Just as if you went to the sun planet, finally. Well, now you know the source of that sunshine that's everywhere. Now you know where that sun that's on everyone's head has its final source. When you come to the sun planet, then you know everything about the sun. If you are only in the sunshine, you still have to go further. But if you're in the sun planet, you know the sunshine automatically. So all three are the same Supreme, realized progressively, impersonally, in the internal local feature, and finally as the personality of Godhead. How's that? Okay.
One more question.
Sure.
Can you find the Supreme, or close to the Supreme, by following a religion which has...
Can you find the Supreme or...
Or move closer to...
Move closer to the Supreme.
By following a religion.
By following a religion. Yes. The various methods of...
Or without, sorry.
Excuse me?
Or without following a religion.
Or without following a religion. Can you move closer to the Supreme? Yeah. If you're not following any particular religion... But even if you're searching for the Supreme, that's already the beginning of a process of turning toward the Supreme. Jen, I don't care about the Supreme. Forget the Supreme. There's a nice ad for Bacardi on the way up the stairway. I don't have to go further than that. But out of thousands of people, someone is very serious. I want to understand the Supreme. I want to understand the ultimate. So that in itself is a religion or transcendence. You can say it's part of the process of Dharma. And now I'm not interested so much in how I'm going to be high here. I'm interested in how I'm going to revive my spiritual nature. So that's automatically religion.
I am following the religion.
Yeah, every one of us, you could say, is following some religion. Even if my religion is, I want to gratify my senses as much as I can. Well, we make a religion out of that. You know, then we celebrate our sacred rites every weekend. So, but that's a very mundane sort of religion, turning away from the Supreme, turning towards something which is temporary, which relates more to the body than to our eternal nature. So then we turn toward the Supreme, and then there are different processes given in different countries at different times by different prophets or different teachers, which are meant to help us make progress. And someone says, well, just like Lord Buddha, Buddha especially teaches nonviolence, because if we're violent toward other living beings, that impedes us in spiritual progress. That impedes us in spiritual progress. And then there are other different spiritual teachings that come at different times, different places, to help us, to enable us to move forward. Okay. Yes?
At the end of your talk, you were talking about...
A little louder?
At the end of the talk that you gave, there was sort of mistake you talked about, and I don't know if I understood that correctly.
At the end of the talk, there was a state that I talked about? A mistake, yes. I need to clarify what that mistake is. Okay. The mistake is that I'm thinking that this material, that I'm this body. That's the first mistake. I think I'm American. I'm South African. I'm German. I'm French. I'm Indian. I'm Italian. I'm white. I'm black. I'm thin. I'm fat. I'm young. I'm old. I'm Smith. I'm Smuts. I'm this. I'm that. I'm thinking in terms of this body, which is not myself. The body is a temporary thing. It's really a machine, if you think about it. Pneumatic and hydraulic, and it has all these rubber bands and stuff that keeps it going. It's a machine. But I have to ask myself, am I this machine? Is that really what I am? Am I an automaton? Thank you. Am I really just a machine? Is that what I am? Is my consciousness just an epiphenomenon of matter? Is it just something produced from the machinery? And if I am, if you follow that to its end, your life is meaningless. Your life has no more meaning than that of, well, this microphone, which is a machine, it has a little diaphragm that responds to air pressure. And if I were to throw it out the window, well, we'd miss the machine, but we go out and get another one. And there'd be nothing to lament over, there'd be nothing to cry over. In the Vietnam War, America spent so much money on bombs and napalm and all these things. And no one protested that we've lost so much napalm. We've lost so many bombs. We can't go on like this. Because it's just a batch of chemicals. It's just a batch of matter. But if one child was killed, then it was felt acutely. Why? If the child is just another but more sophisticated arrangement of matter, just a very sophisticated chemical process that's going on, so if you end that very sophisticated chemical process, so why? If I'm just a sophisticated chemical process and one of you decides to shoot me, it's really no worse than, say, knocking a glass of water off the table. So if you follow the line of thinking, that really we're nothing more than sort of biological, chemical machines, then you arrive at the conclusion that life is really meaningless. That's where it goes. And if we don't just subscribe to that, but we sort of get it by the process of osmosis, where we adopt these assumptions, where we just sort of automatically work with the understanding that, well, of course I'm American, I'm Indian, I'm white, I'm black, I'm 30 or 20 or 40 or 60, I'm thin or I'm fat, my teeth stick out too much or they don't stick out enough or whatever, my nose needs to be adjusted. Because I'm this body, I'm thinking essentially in terms of this body. I'm thinking in terms of a lifetime that's going to, if I think that long, that lasts for, say, upwards to maybe 100 years, and then it's finished, and that's the end of me. Well, that's the mistake. That I'm thinking in terms of matter and missing my actual identity as spirit or consciousness. Yeah? Within the body, the conscious force is there. When the conscious force, when spirit leaves the body, then the body is useless. And the same person that I loved, I put in the ground. So correcting that mistake means, first of all, understanding, identifying myself with consciousness, with spirit, which is with a permanent entity and not with a temporary covering of that entity. And then we go on from there and say, well, what is the engagement of that entity? If I'm American, then I vote, I serve in the army, I give people a hard time all over the world. But if I'm spirit, what do? What is my engagement in spirit? Do I just sit here and say, I'm spirit, I'm not matter, I'm spirit? There must be some engagement for spirit. When the spirit connects with the supreme, then there's spiritual engagement. And that's the subject of bhakti yoga. Then okay. More? You want to ask? Go ahead.
No, it's good. I misunderstood that the mistake is being in the body, but you talk about the conception of what the body is.
Yeah, the conception that the body is myself. That's the mistake. Body is there, and I'm misidentifying with it. That's the mistake. Something else? Who has another question bubbling up there? Yes?
I would like to ask, how does sort of meditation and chanting, how would you sort of connect from spirit to the supreme by doing that? How would that work?
Okay. How do we connect with the supreme by meditation or chanting? The center of our life, you can say, is the mind. Where my mind goes, I go. If my mind is on, anything, you can understand. You're thinking about business, so then you go to business school. You're thinking about the arts, so then you take art courses. Where does it start with? It starts with your mind. If my mind is uncontrolled, my mind becomes my worst enemy. And if I control my mind, my mind becomes my best friend. Well, I control it. What do? If I control it, just say, you can't do anything. No. One should elevate oneself by oneself. Elevate one's mind by one's intelligence. Then, what is that elevation? First, it's to withdraw my mind from preoccupation with matter and direct it towards spirit. Doesn't mean I can't deal with matter, but not to be preoccupied, like a person is preoccupied with his car. You know, cars are fine, you drive them, you use them, but some people just get absorbed in their car and they're missing everything else in life. So now we're absorbed in matter. So the mind should be turned toward spirit, and ultimately the mind should be turned toward the Supreme. Now, there are different ways to do that. I guess you're familiar with the sort of classic yoga system where you sit in postures and you breathe in a certain way and you fix your eyes on the tip of the nose and all of that. That's one method of meditation. And it's mentioned, it's described, in fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, how to do that. And the goal is that the mind just gets withdrawn from external things and focused on the Supreme. But it's difficult. Just to sit silently and meditate like that, the mind will wander. The mind will go here, there, and everywhere. Therefore, the actual yoga system involves very strict discipline, which, without going into it, practically no one can follow these days. So, in the present age, chanting of mantras is more recommended. What is a mantra? It's a transcendental sound. It's a transcendental sound. The Supreme can be present in sound. Supreme can be present in sound. I'm chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. There's only three sounds there, Krishna, Rama, and Hare. So what are they? Krishna addresses the Supreme. It means all attractive. The Supreme must be supremely attractive. If something's more attractive than the Supreme, you just outdid the Supreme. So, attractive. And Rama means the reservoir of all pleasure. If there's pleasure coming from someplace else, beyond the Supreme again, well then, you just outdid the Supreme again. So, the reservoir of pleasure, the source of all attraction. And Hare addresses the energy of the Supreme. Just as you have the sun and the sunshine, so you have the Supreme and the energy of the Supreme. Without energy, any conception of the Supreme is incomplete. Just like if I know about you, I have to know about your energies, your strength or your intelligence or your wealth or something about you that represents your energy. Just you sitting there, that's not you. You're you with your energy. So the Supreme is properly understood or adequately understood when we take into account the energy of the Supreme. So Hare Krishna approaches the Supreme through the energy of the Supreme and focuses our mind there. And that's a very potent way of meditation in the present age. Okay? And I wonder what other questions might be there between the bites.
If you kill someone, their spirit soul is going to carry on existing anyway. Mm-hmm. So still, it doesn't matter if you kill someone, you're dead.
Mm-hmm. I said that if everything's matter, it ultimately doesn't matter whether you kill someone or not, whether someone dies or not. So you're turning that around and say, well, if everything's spirit, if everything's eternal, then it doesn't matter if you kill someone or not. And that has a truth to it. Rather than say, oh, no, no, no. There's a truth to that. What is that? Nayam hanti nayam hanti. Suppose you kill me. You're smiling. It looks like you're not disposed to do it today. But But suppose you were to kill me. Actually, I don't die, because I'm not this body. You've terminated the physical process. You've smashed the machine. But when you smash, say, a car, it doesn't mean that the driver is smashed. The driver can get out of the total wreck and go on and get a new car. So killing me doesn't actually kill me. Therefore, Socrates, when they sentenced him to die by drinking hemlock, he was asked, well, how should we put you in the grave? And he said, well, first you catch me, and then you put me in the grave. Because he had that understanding that the body is not the self. So from that point of view, the self-realized person doesn't lament when someone dies or when someone's killed. He knows that person hasn't been killed, only the machine has been destroyed, totaled. Now, but because of that, we can all go around having a field day and killing one another when we're bored or pestered. But then there's a larger consideration. To whom does this machinery belong? Is it all just, like with machines here, do I have a right to go around just saying, phew, I really enjoy totaling that car. I think a few of my friends and I will just take jackhammers and smash this car just for the fun of it. It's not our property. It's not our property. The Upanishads say that one should see everything as the energy of the Supreme, and everything is the property of the Supreme. And there's the spiritual vision just doesn't mean, again, it's not, I'm the center, and if I want to smash it, or if I want to do this to it, or if I want to grab it, well, it's all up to me. No. There's a humility there that I'm not the proprietor or controller of anything. That I'm, this is borrowed property. It's property of the Supreme. It should be used for the Supreme, or I should see the connection with the Supreme. That's in one sense the problem of modern society, that the connection in our minds is severed. So, for example, well, any tract of land, we can argue about it, and America will claim it, and France will claim it, and Germany will claim it, and maybe even the local people might claim it. But it's not our property. Maybe we'll get together in France and Germany and England and America and say, okay, gentlemen, let's divide this judiciously, fairly, honestly. Rather than fight, we should divide it fairly. But it's not ours. It doesn't belong to France or Germany or Italy or anybody else. It's property of the Supreme. So we're like thieves dividing honestly. We steal the stuff, and then we divide it fairly. Which is why it doesn't work, because we're all thieves at the end of the day. The thieves can't divide honestly. So nor can we be happy with stolen property. We'll always be looking over our shoulder, wondering if somebody's going to come, like the owner, and give me a hard time. So that's another aspect of spiritual realization, seeing that I have a connection with the Supreme and seeing everything else has a connection with the Supreme also. And I have to respect that connection. I can't just grab or destroy. I have to see everything in relationship to that Supreme Truth. If you see everything in relation to the Supreme Truth, you have true vision. When we disconnect everything from truth, then where are we? We're an illusion, aren't we? And that's how the world is going on, in multiple illusions, or in exponentially increasing the illusion, all starting with this misconception that I'm the body, I'm the center of everything, and in forgetfulness of the Supreme or the Ultimate or the God. Yes?
It sounds like I missed an interesting proof about the reincarnation of the...
Give that to me again, the door got
it. Sounds like I missed an interesting talk regarding reincarnation last week. But my question to you is, reincarnation, do all souls that have passed leave the physical?
Do all souls
that has left the physical body come back as a new human?
Do all souls that have a physical body come back as a new human? No. Because we see that humans are not the only kind of living beings that we have. If you define a living being as a conscious living entity, a conscious self, human beings can't claim the exclusive distinction of being conscious living beings. We have our little dogs and cats, they have consciousness. Sheep and goats and cows and horses have consciousness, ants have consciousness, birds have consciousness, trees.
But is it a continuous recycling?
Yeah, we can recycle. Just like sometimes you meet somebody, and after you meet him and he's gone, you say to your friend, "My God, that guy's a pig." Right? He just behaves like a pig, he eats like a pig, he has the habits of a pig. He's like, "Man, that guy's a pig." And practically speaking, he has the mentality of a pig. Well, the Bhagavad Gita says that the mind is what brings us to the next body. It's our mind that the body is formed around. And so if I have the mind of a pig, then the next body may be that of a pig. Why should nature award me the body of a philosopher? When really what I want out of life is the same thing that a pig wants out of life. Why misallocate resources? Nature says, this guy's a pig. He wants to be a pig, he's already practically a pig, so let him have that kind of body. Sometimes there are a lot of different examples of the kind of body that one might get according to one's mind. Ultimately, the yoga process is to get free from this process, from this repetition of birth and death in different bodies, and get a return to our spiritual form. That's called liberation, to assume a spiritual form in the spiritual atmosphere or the spiritual world. Yes.
On that note, what about a figure such as you mentioned, Socrates earlier, who was a philosopher, who lived that life?
I missed the name.
Socrates.
Socrates, yes.
Who lived that life, who was a philosopher, or
a philosopher.
Yes, exactly. What about the you're saying the reincarnation then? What is the next level? Do you get to a point where there is no next level, or is that enlightenment?
Good. Do you get to a point where there's no level? Socrates had a level of enlightenment. So then where do you go? Do you reach the end of it? So generally, just as a person, you say, he's a pig. He may come back as a pig. A person who's a philosopher is a person who's elevating himself beyond lower concerns, beyond ignorance, beyond our ordinary passions. He's seeking and trying to understand a higher reality. So he may come back again as a philosopher, because the process of seeking the Supreme may take more than one lifetime. But when one actually realizes the Supreme, in the Bhagavad Gita it said, after many, many births, when one finally reaches the Supreme or connects with the personality of Godhead, then his birth and death is finished. It's a kind of diseased condition to keep being born and dying, born and dying. It's not a healthy condition. But there is a healthy condition. beyond our present scope of experience. Just as there's a material world, and practically every religion speaks about the spiritual world. It's almost implied when you say darkness, light is implied. When you say material world, the spiritual world is implied. If I'm a spiritual being, then I have to be somewhere. But now I'm in a place which is not of my nature. It's not spiritual. It's not permanent. But I'm looking for something permanent. Even a cockroach who's trying to kill him, he runs away because he's seeking a perpetual existence. So practically religion, the scriptures of every religion and philosophical philosophers also, they're saying, no, there's also a spiritual realm, a spiritual place. And that's where we should go. And there, there's no birth and death. Birth and death are far into that place, just as it's endemic in this one. Okay. Yes.
Can you be reincarnated into a world, another world other than this one, into a species that does not exist in this world?
Could you be reincarnated into a world other than this one, in species that don't exist in this one? Yes. In the Vedic literature, of course, we think our world is the only world. Life only exists here. But according to the Vedic literature, out of so many planets, there are many different kinds of living beings. And so one could take birth in one of those worlds and one of those species also. But it's ultimately frustrating. Just as I may live in some low-class place and where life is very difficult, or I may live in some exclusive suburb where everybody's got a mansion and 3 or 4 BMWs and so on. But both are places of birth and death. Both are places, are foreign places. It's like the third-class jail cell or the first-class jail cell. Either way, I'm in jail. So the Vedic literature says that even if you travel to all the planets of the universe, if you could go to all of them and sample the offerings, you'd be dissatisfied. You'd find that they're all places of birth and death. So the whole material world is an unsuitable place for a gentleman. We should seek out that place beyond birth and death. That's the Vedic direction. I see a question over on this side.
Yeah, I was just wondering, are we all kind of like spirits? Like, are spirits made now, or are we all living there before? Do you know what I'm saying?
Are we all spirits now?
Like, no, have we all been reincarnated?
Have we all been reincarnated?
Are some of us new spirits?
Are some of us new? Good question. Yeah, the implication of our having next births is that we've had previous ones. It's something like being in this room. Here we all are, and we've come from all different directions. Some of you may have been in biology labs. Some of you may have been in a poli-sci class. Some of you may have been here or there. But you've all come from your various rooms you were in. Now you're here. And we'll all file out of here gradually, and then we'll be someplace else. It's not that when you walk out, you'll cease to exist. And it's not that you didn't exist before you came here. So similarly, the nature of spirit, the nature of consciousness, is that it's not created. It's not something that bubble, 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 you put the right stuff together and then boom, consciousness comes. It's a fundamentally different substance. As matter is always like that, you put it together and you get something. But consciousness is can't be created that way. It always exists. And it can't be destroyed. You can't cut it up. You can't burn it. You can't drown it. You can't blow it away. Material circumstances can't end it. Because it's by nature ever existing. It's not a material thing that you can cut or dry or burn or blow away. So it means we were someplace else. Now we're here. We'll go someplace else. But where we're going is around and around in the material world. and where the different methods of yoga are trying to direct us is beyond birth and death. Okay? Is there another question floating around in someone's thoughts? Yes.
So did the Supreme Court not make the decision that I will be born, that I will be fertilized in my mother's womb and be born? Who made that decision that
okay.
I will be?
Okay, I need a little help here because your voice is soft.
Okay. Who decided that I will be born?
Okay, who decides that I'll be born? In one sense, I decide, because I say, I want whatever it is. And because I want it, I have to come back for it. My attachment obliges me to come back. Above all of this is the Supreme, there's God, there's Supreme Intelligence, who sets up the thing, arranges things in a certain way. And then there's my own participation in the matter, where someone comes and says, what are you staying in the material world for? Why don't you direct yourself back to the Supreme? You say, no. I want to be whatever it is I want to be. I want to do X. I want to be an aviator. I want to be able to fly. I may come back as a bird. There was a... back in the 1950s, there was an actor whose name I've forgotten, who starred in all the old black and white Tarzan movies. Weissmiller, that was his name. First name escapes me. He was an Olympic swimming star. And so in the old Tarzan movies, they'd always have a scene where he'd be like diving off a 300-foot cliff into the ocean or something. It's quite good. And then in his old age, he went rather soft and would spend his time just, I think, in a wheelchair, looking out over the ocean, wallowing. So that's the sort of focus that could give us the life of a fish. It's his choice. He could be thinking of getting out of this material world, could be thinking of the Supreme, could be thinking of how to elevate his consciousness. But he's thinking longingly to how to get back into the sea. Well, then that's the sort of thought that can result in a fish body. Because my attachment takes me to my next destination. I'm longing for a diamond, so I wind up in the jewelry store. Or I'm longing for a drink, I wind up in the tavern. I'm longing for philosophical knowledge, I wind up in the library. So my desires, my attachments, my aspirations are what lead me in whatever direction I'm going in. And that's what leads me to my next body. Or if I'm aspiring to get free from this material world, that impulse, that desire is what can start me on the path of freedom from material existence altogether. Okay, yes?
So to add on to the Gold's question, is consciousness created or is it just...
Is consciousness created? Adding on to her question.
With our human population numbers exponentially increasing, somewhere we're putting consciousness out of a big pool of energy, say out of the ocean. Fish wants to become human because there hasn't been so many humans.
Of course, there's two questions there, I think. One is whether consciousness is created at some point, and the other is, I suppose, how we explain the exponentially increasing human population. Okay, let's deal with that exponentially increasing human population first. It's tiddlywinks, which is American slang for insignificant. If everyone in Cape Town could vote, the human vote would be lost because there's so many butterflies, there's so many ants, there's so many microbes, there are so many blades of grass, there are so many living beings. The human population is a tiny fraction. To put that together with your first question, thank you. To put that together with your first question, our consciousness is not created. It's fundamentally different. Matter is always created, destroyed. Material things are created. This body, it's created at a certain point by the combination of the mother and father, and it springs into existence. At some point, it's gone. It ceases to exist. That's the nature of matter. It's created, destroyed, created, destroyed, created, destroyed. And nature is a fundamentally different spirit is a fundamentally different substance. Your body goes through so many changes. Again, the childhood body, the youthful body. But consciousness continues to persist through all those changes of body. I remember when I was a child, I was jumping, I was playing. The same I is present now, even though the body is not present.
So that implies that plants and animals have consciousness?
Sure. Otherwise, what's the difference between a living animal and a dead one? It's not just, you know, like theology, they have a soul. If you look at it, there's a living dog and a dead dog. What's the difference? It's consciousness, isn't it? The living dog has feelings. The living dog has desires. Living dog has thoughts, maybe not Socratic thoughts, maybe not even pre-Socratic thoughts, but some sort of thought like, gee, there's a bone over there, and I think if, or there's something, like a cat. The cat wants the milk that's sitting on your table. But the cat thinks about it and says, if I go and jump on it now, he'll chase me away. I'll wait till he leaves the kitchen, and then I'll jump up and get it. Well, that's thought. So the living animal has thought, has feeling, has desire, perception. You pinch the dog feels it. And the dead dog, no thought, no feeling, no desire. Why? Consciousness is gone. The tree, even. I think experiments have been done that trees respond even to people's feelings. Trees respond to different circumstances. They have feelings. Primitive, but they're trapped in a particular body where they don't have much scope for the expression of thought or desire or feeling. They can't even move around. So the body restricts them, but the consciousness is there. Therefore, you see the tree dies. Then you say, well, that's that. And no more. Is there life in the tree? So that life in the tree, that living force in the tree, in the dog, in the human being, are common. A living dog and a dead dog and a dead human being are pretty much the same thing. Once the life is gone, it's just a body. And when the life is there, in one sense, it's also the same thing. It's a living being, whether it's a dog or a tree or a human being. The consciousness is of the same nature, but it's expressed differently according to the body. An old man expresses his existence differently from a young child, but they both express their existence as conscious beings. Dog, the bird, they express their conscious existence differently in terms of their different bodies. But the truth, the principle of consciousness is the same within all of those bodies. Because essentially the same entity is moving from one kind of body to the next. Now I have a man's body, next life I might have a woman's body, next life I might have a bird's body. Consciousness, just as today I might have a Toyota, tomorrow I might have a BMW, the next day I might have an old wreck. but the machinery is changing, but I'm the same person. I'm a driver. Whatever the machine, I'm the driver. So we're the driver within the machine of the body, or we're the person within the machine, not the machine. Mm-hmm.
Why do some people remember their previous life and some don't?
Why do some people remember their previous life? Generally, no one does. As a rule, we don't. I can't even remember where I left my car keys this morning. We were all in a womb at one time, and 300 rand for anyone who can remember anything from then. We forget. That's nature's law, is that as we change bodies, we forget. Even I forget. I've forgotten most of what happened when I was, I think I've forgotten everything that happened when I was 5 years old. It's all gone because the body has changed and memory fades. So when we completely change the body, then we might have remembered from our earliest days, it's all gone. Rarely, there are cases in which someone seems to remember. There are cases. There's a psychiatrist, actually. Now he himself has expired a few years ago, at the University of Virginia, who wrote many formidable books about case histories of children who seemed to remember a previous life. He didn't deal with hypnotic cases and so on because there's too much static. I remember my life as Cleopatra, but how many books did I read about Cleopatra? How many movies did I see? But when a child, say, 5 years old, begins to speak about a previous life, and when the life that he speaks about, or the details of the life that he speaks about, correspond to the life of a person who actually lived, you start to get an interesting case. And when, as in some cases, there are physical features of that child that in some way correspond to the physical features of that other person. For example, if he has some unusual birthmarks that correspond to, bullet wounds by which the previous person was killed. Well, you get a very interesting case, don't you? So he collected several thousand such cases and published extensive scientific reports about them. Generally, the child, after begins to speak that way at a young age, maybe when he first begins to talk, and by about 10 or 12, the memories usually fade. And he also found that there was no appreciable benefit. It's not that the child who remembered his previous life had a wonderful life and all of his problems were gone because that didn't happen. But it's an apparent anomaly of nature that some people may remember something of their previous life, although generally not. Okay. Yes?
Is there seem to be a period of limbo?
A period of?
Limbo.
Limbo.
As in, say, there was a nobleman, but he was very poor, and he couldn't really achieve what he was going for. And now he will be born into a more, not necessarily better family, but better circumstances to help him achieve his life. But is it then that this spirit is waiting in limbo for the correct situation to be born? Mm. Or is it immediate?
According to the Vedic literature, nature is pretty efficient. So there's not a long waiting in the queue. There's the usual period of gestation. So 9 months, one is going to be born as a human being. But otherwise, the transfer is immediate, just as I walk out of this room and I'm in the next room, just like that. So sort of transfer from one life to the next is generally immediate. That's what we get from Bhagavad Gita. Yes?
So would you say that to get out of the cycle of reincarnation is just as simple as getting rid of desire or attachment, or is there something more?
Is reincarnation get as simple as getting free from desire and attachment, or is there something more? There's something more. Because on one side, there's, what's keeping me here is my desire and my attachment. And if I let go of that, then I should be free of desire and attachment. And that may be enough, that one becomes free from desire and attachment, and so now he doesn't have to take birth again. But then where does he go? If I'm not finished, if I don't cease to exist, then all right, I'm not here anymore, but where do I go? So there's a positive side also. The negative side is no attachment, no material desire, no material longings and clingings. That's the negative. I don't want that. But there must be something positive also. If I'm actually going to go somewhere, if I'm actually going to achieve something beyond this material existence. But that's our relationship with the Supreme. Otherwise, it's sort of like not being in a diseased condition, but not being healthy. You know, like you're lying in hospital, and you're okay. You don't have diphtheria anymore, but you're still lying in your bed in the hospital. That's not life. That's not healthy life. Healthy life is when you go out and play soccer again, or your whatever it is that you like to do. That's healthy life. Otherwise, it's sort of recuperation. So there's, on the one side, there's getting free from material attachment or material longings. And on the other side, there's reviving my spiritual connection, my spiritual active nature, my spiritual identity. Just as I have a material false identity, material temporary identity that I've assumed, there's a spiritual identity also. So we can, the Bhakti Yoga system aims at reviving that. If you have any other questions, you're welcome to ask us. I guess I'll be sitting here for a little bit longer. If you have anyone to ask personally. Otherwise, I see our books are there. This Bhagavad Gita is there, and other books which address the topics that I'm talking about. I think you'd find a lot of value there. Last chance, any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much.
I'd like to thank Maharaj very much for taking his time and trouble to come here. Please give him a nice round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you.
In India, there are many ashrams where people follow spirits, follow a way of life that's meant to be conducive to spiritual.
Is it referring to the same kind?
Well, there are different ideas that people have. Some of these ashrams are really bad. Get the cheese. Yeah. Good money is collected, and people. Then they're leaving them aside. Places for spiritual culture. They're generally directed. You can divide them up according to the organization of the school. There are those who try to cultivate a sort of relationship with the world. There are those who are sort of philanthropic meditation. There are those who are aspiring for the personal realization that we were talking about, but maybe want to purge or discipline or something like that. And then there are ashrams where people are pursuing personal realization.
Someone's
all such literature is meant to take us away from the material and toward God. How the presentation is given at different points. But the objective is the same, to provide the eternal nature of the world. So in that sense, you say that they're all authentic. And now that we get to conflict, which is what I'm saying. Now, what does that mean? What do I have to do? Do I just, you know, get up in the stadium and sign the paper and say, well, now what is he actually teaching? So that requires some thought, some discrimination, some
Yes. Yes, that's the trick of the thesis.
What do I do?
Yeah.
Christians today, they will always say Jesus is God, and it
is the material.
So Christianity has basically warped.
Well, in early Christianity, that was a hotly debated question, more than debated. It became, well, it was tremendously. There was almost a war over it. Is Jesus God? Is Jesus different from God? If he's God, if he's God, and you just consider him like a man, then we're offending the divine. If we accept him as God and deny his humanity, then we're minimizing his sacrifice. So there was a huge debate that raged for decades, about the divinity of Jesus. And it may still be debated today. Debated literature offers a nice perspective on that. It offers a sort of a broader understanding in which that question can be addressed. Because in the Vedic conception, this idea of the descent of God to the material world.
Many perspective is that Jesus is a Shaktavis.
He's representing, he's in power, he's a living being empowered by God. So God is present through his empowerment. Yes, he's divine. But he's not God, otherwise I'm sitting on the right hand. The right hand of God. How do you sit on the right hand of yourself? So Lord Chaitanya is teaching Well, that's up to you. For some people, it's 6 months. For some people, it's a year. Some people, it's 12 years. Some people, it's their whole life. So that's up to you. But in the broader context, the one who controls the sex organs will lead a happier life. If one can live a life of celibacy, taking some blood trouble.
And then also the philosophy behind it is that the vital fluid that is saved gets turned into vajrasura or something.
And that's the physiological.
And it goes upwards towards the
at the same time. And
do you need to do any exercises to hit this, or will this automatically happen over time?
That's automatic. In previous ages, they would do various sorts of yogic exercises that would assist in that. But they're essentially ineffective in the present age. The main thing actually that helps is to turn the mind away from matter and toward Krishna. The mind is on Krishna, and it's not on material things. And it's the mind really that's the crucial.
About Jhana Yoga.
About Jhana Yoga.
It Yeah.
The sutras are say that the oneness is there, but the oneness comprehends why
most of all. As in, what I'm saying, when we die, this body dies, I don't believe that there is some afterlife, that there exist as separate souls, I believe it's all one.
If it's all one, there's several things that can be said to that. Yeah, and why does this all get started if we're all one? Why did we start with the rest? For that matter, let's say the idea is right that we're all one. And by omission, we're all reincarnated, expecting ourselves to be self-realized. Now let's say we become self-realized. Now my reincarnation should be done. I should also be self-realized. Since there's no difference between you and me, now you change the action. Let's say there's some teacher somewhere, maybe it's, you know, the master of this world, and he attained the perfection. All of us here now attain the perfection.
I see it. What you're saying, like, you can fit two things, I can think differently. Like, there's individual consciousness. I still feel in the sense that it happens like an illusion.
Or 50% on you and 60% on me. We're all the same. We're all under the illusion of our relationship that doesn't we're all the same person. If there's oneness, then there should be uniformity. If it exists, logical explanation is not simply because logic is, you know, the power of logic is limited. Because it's an eternity, philosophically, you know, you can say it's so high that it's beyond what it is. But the other way to look at it is to say it's self-contradictory.
Like logic or illogical is irrelevant because you wouldn't be able to get there to
it. Yeah, that may be true, but then you can toss out philosophy.
It's useless talking about it.
Then philosophy is useless. Everything becomes more or less useless. I'm not even going to think about whether what I'm doing makes sense or whether what I'm subscribing to makes sense because it's all another. You know, at least within the realm of ours, logic, we have to look and say, well, does this have some prospect of success? Or is it already, you know, at the basement level?
If you cut your finger, I'm not going to feel it. If
I cut mine, you're not going to feel. I'm in this body, you're in that body. So there's oneness and there's difference. You know, you're South African and he's South African, so you're one. But yet, you're you and he's him. You're different. To say that you're entirely different is wrong, because you're both South African. But to say that you're entirely one is also wrong, because you're individual. So you're just as South African as the president of South Africa. But that doesn't give you the powers of the president.
Like you said.
Right.
Thanks a lot.
Do we have an Ishopanishad here?
Sure.
There's a book that really addresses this question very, very well. And this is it. It's called Ishopanishad. You've heard of the Upanishads, perhaps? They're the headlines of the Vedas. There's 108 of them. And this is a short. There's only about 18 mantras. And this is a translation and commentary on one of the Upanishads. And it deals extensively with that very issue that you're bringing up.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been coming to the society, this is my third year, and it makes sense to me, but what I still feel, I think it may have been my religious upbringing in the Christian church, just gave me a very deep suspicion of trusting any, I'm just blindly following any knowledge, like any text or just something that another person says.
That doesn't sound like this very Christian attitude.
Well, that's why I left the church, because I felt like, you know, the basic components make sense to me, being compassionate, serving God, stuff like that. When it comes down to all the small rules and regulations, did God really write this? Is it really the word of God? And you know, after being in a world of illusion, anything material can be illusion. So if something written down in a book, it's also illusion. So how do you know it's truth? And that's why I find this still can't really get beyond this, is because in the it still comes back to different texts, but now it's the Vedic texts. And the same school, it's the same. So, you know, this text is the correct one. Everyone's contemptuous of this one. And I don't know, am I just too attached to a certain idea or a concept?
For a person who's self realized, he's indifferent to whatever you might hear. The texts are no longer his focus of attention. Kind of like a map once you've got there. It's not no longer important. To the person's attained self-realization, texts are no longer crucial, no longer of great importance. So that's the highest stage, when you come to that point where, why do I have to think about texts?
So that's still any text.
Any text, just Christian or Vedic or Muslim or any other kind of texts. Texts serve to point us to a goal. And once you reach the goal, then the texts become, you can be indifferent to the text. Meanwhile, along the way, the texts are mental health. They're not the be-all and end-all. My life is just for textuality, for strict adherence to a text. Okay, I threw the 3 drops over my left shoulder, and then I threw the 5 drops over my right shoulder, and then I spun around 3 times, and then I, you know, threw some rice in the air, or, you know, whatever it is. Some 4 Hail Marys, to our Father, you know, whatever it is, right, down to our Mecca, seven times, whatever, that's not the point. If we make the rules and regulations the goal of themselves, then we're missing. And learning music, if you just make scales of everything, you're missing what music is about. But music begins by learning scales. You know, once you learn the scales, then you can improvise and you get the feeling of the music, and you become Mozart or Bach. Someone who's got an appreciation of music. So we may follow these rules or those rules, or this text or that text, but you have to see where the text is
pointing. The first three letters at the beginning, the middle, so that's Shatavarma, is the manifestation of the Supreme Self.
Yeah. Lord Chaitanya's movement is revolutionary in a sense, because it takes things out of the hands of textual professionals. You get the Brahmins, who are sort of the priestly class of people who interpret the texts or consult the texts and say, okay, for the interior of Lord Chaitanya takes it out of their hands. He says, this chanting is offensive. By this transcendental sound, one goes beyond the various rituals. These Vedic rituals and those Vedic rituals bring in rituals from other traditions. Lord Chaitanya says that this chanting of the transcendental sound transcends these things. It brings one to the platform beyond rituals, beyond texts, beyond all of these places where one can do that kind of thing. He gave so much emphasis on this spiritual cultivation through chanting. And he explicitly said, no hard and fast rules for chanting. Not that you have to, okay, you dress this way, and then you, a certain hour you go to a certain place, and then you sit in a certain way. Any place. Any person. Any time. Any circumstance. Really taking it beyond the level of we can get stuck in the rituals. We think, I'm following all these rituals now. I'm doing good. But the rituals are not the goal. But the chanting, because the name of God is transcendental, the chanting of the holy name and the association with God. So in that sense, the means and the goal are controlled. You reach Krishna by associating with Krishna. That's a transcendental test.
That's another test.
Or are you
I have a question about something I've been experiencing in Malaysia, actually.
You're going to have
unsustainable.
meditation means fixing the mind. The distinct about that is meditation. Diverging myself. What is that?
It's not like Coca-Cola.
No, it's not
just how much emotion you put into it. But the sound itself is a transcendence. The absolute sense of access.
I think
capacity to focus, absorb one's attention, to hear oneself, to have sincere.
You can take advantage of that giving it to every night, every month. Every night, seven to less than eight.
Yeah, I was going to do that.
He's my manager. He's practical. I just talked to him.
Thank you,
Raj.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
And I hope you like the students.
Fabulous.
I'm happy if you have me. And please, if you do come back to Cape Town, please visit us again in Stellenbosch.
I'd be happy to. Very good group. Good questions. Listen carefully.
Yeah. I think we've got a nice group of students this year.
Close.
I really like